Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com. This is Futures in Biotech, Episode 3 for August 10th, 2006. From the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Dr. Mark Vidal. Welcome to another edition of Futures in Biotech. I'm Leo Laporte with Mark Pelletier. This week, a great guest. Now, this is going to get a little technical. Tell us a little bit about Dr. Vidal, Mark.
Our guest today, his name is Dr. Mark Vidal. He's an associate professor at the Department of Cancer Biology. He's the director of the Center for Cancer Systems Biology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and he's an associate professor of genetics at Harvard Medical School. Hello, Mark.
Hello, guys.
It's great to have you. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute is a big name in cancer. What is it like the Mayo Clinic? What is its mission?
Yeah, its mission is to basically help patients, right? Hopefully try to cure the patients from this disease, practically really treating them for most of the cancers. And to do that with compassion and always looking for high quality of care. And of course, on the other side of all the clinical stuff I just told you about is to stay at the top of the research part, which, of course, the two activities, as you can imagine, are intimately linked, right? You get the best doctors if you have the best research and vice versa. So that would be the mission, I guess.
And the Vidal Lab is home is at the Dana-Farber Cancer.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yes, we're home at the Dana-Farber. I have to, so people know about this, I don't myself have an MD degree. I don't see patients. I'm interested in my work mostly because I do see the patients coming in and out. And as you can imagine, you know, sometimes hairless and that sort of thing, you see all kinds of stuff. But I'm not taking care of patients myself. The sort of work we do is supposedly, going to help us in the mid and long term in trying to understand the basic stuff of cancer.
Do you find you're motivated, though, when you see those patients coming and going?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I mean, it's, you see kids, you see people of all ages, of course, as well. But yes, you are motivated. And it's a good place. I mean, it's relatively small. People don't really realize that. So most of the employees here still know each other and that sort of thing.
I mean, it's world famous. I mean, it's...
Yeah, you're right. I think so.
Tell us about your research.
Well, it's sort of in a chronological, I sort of like to find out how you got involved, because some of the projects you do are what I call extreme biotech, and sort of the buildup of extreme biotech requires sort of an understanding of where you come from and how you sort of came about to asking these questions. So perhaps you could tell us about how you got started in,
in your... Okay. No, that sounds cool. Actually, I was, short story. Actually, when I was young, I trained in Belgium, in Europe, and I trained as an agronomist, this sort of weird name or word that sort of defines, agricultural science or something like that, and which is sort of far away, you might say, from cancer research, but there is a link between the two. And here's what it is that, if you start looking at nature, one way or the other, you try to understand how it works, why sometimes it doesn't work, why people are sick, et cetera, et cetera. And, pretty soon, if you don't have mechanistic explanation of what's going on, you grow frustrated. And that's how I was in the mid-80s, at the end of my studies. And so it turns out molecular biology, and I'm sure we'll go back to those terms in a little bit, but the idea of being able to get your hands on genes and the products of those genes, the so-called proteins, sometimes RNA molecules, and to try to, get your hand on one of them and understanding one of those genes in detail and try to understand how sometimes it's mutated, say, in some people or in some animals, some plants, whatever, and how those mutations will give rise to something different. We say sometimes phenotype, right? We use the word phenotype. That was the sort of the scaffold of my thesis work. And it became, somewhat revealing to me that you could understand part of the biology from looking at genes like this. That was great. And then it turns out you sort of grow out of that and you say, well, that in itself is somewhat frustrating. Why? Because, you know, what is really one gene going to tell you? Because there are so many of them, you know, how do at the end of the day, how do they actually all interact with each other? And that's how I got into this field. I was, I guess at that point, a postdoc. This was in 1993. And the key event for me was, and you guys, I'm sure, will relate back to this. This was the very beginning of the Human Genome Project, right? You might remember that. You know, the sort of the big decisions on the Human Genome Projects were taken at the end of the 80s. And then, you know, the first set of experiments were done in the early 90s. And in 1992, to be precise, there were two papers that came out, one for yeast. You know, one of the model organisms that we use is yeast. And the other paper was for this little worm, C. elegans. It's a nematode. And essentially what those guys had done is they had sequenced a little portion, like 1%, let's say, I don't remember the number, but a small portion of the yeast and the C. elegans genome. And the picture that came out of that was, whoa, you know, it's full of genes. And for most of them, we have no clue what they do. And, you know, and so basically what you know, the image I had at that point was, okay, I can keep doing my, you know, one gene approach. I spent my entire thesis 7 days a week working on one gene, trying to understand how it works. And now all of a sudden we realize it was this entire, you know, huge number of entities, I guess, that we all had to take care of. And so, you know, facing that sort of, you know, complexity, you had to say, how are we going to, you know, try to understand this?
And they were definitely interesting times, though, because every time you come back from a weekend of exposing your film exposing film to your DNA samples, you would see Venus in the waves. You'd have the sequence of a gene that nobody's ever looked at before.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely true, Mark. And actually, you know, imagine this, right? And also there was this feeling of like planting your flag on something, right? So, you knew that this was totally like sort of quote unquote terra incognita, right? So you went in and it took you a number of years, but at the end of the day, you had your gene, you had the sequence for that gene, you know, you were the only one sometimes you were scooped, but, you know, many times you were the only ones who'd ever done that, you know. And that was the exciting part, because most of the genome was a black box, and so you really, you know, you basically took a small part of that and you went into the details of it. But, you know, think about this, right? I'm sure we'll use plenty of analogies throughout this hour, and sometimes they'll be good, sometimes they'll be bad, and you guys will tell me, and you'll stop me when they're bad analogies, okay? But
you'll hear our groans.
Actually, Leo is going to be the one who's going to have to stop us on this one.
I'm sure they'll all be fine. One of the things we've found, Mark, is that people like you and your position are very good, in fact, at explaining your research, because it's as technical as it is, I think you're often called upon to explain to people like me.
Yeah, and I think it's important. So that's why I'm enjoying doing this podcast. By the way, thank you for inviting me. So I want to say
we're thrilled
publicly
to have you
here. This is great.
Excellent.
You were like number one or number two on the list, Mark. So glad we could get you.
Thank you.
Number one, two, because of scheduling.
Yeah, I was going to say number one to invite.
No, sorry, Dr. Lincoln.
Or to avoid.
No, to invite.
To invite. Okay, cool. So you know, the example, one of the examples that people use all the time is, say you knew as much as you can ever imagine. Say you knew almost everything about all the parts of a Boeing 757. You know, so you would have a list of, first of all, you would have a complete list of all its parts. And then for each part, somebody will tell you, you know, about 3, 4, 5 features of each one of those parts. You know, that wouldn't explain to you, describe, or definitely not model in mathematical terms, you know, how the plane actually takes off and lands, right? And many other aspects of the plane. So that's where that really was a frustration, I think, of many of us sort of in the mid-90s. It's like, okay, so even if we went faster, even if we could do the one gene approach more and more and more, you know, faster and faster and faster, would we be able to understand the whole, you know, which is this whole, you know, debate about reductionism versus sometimes it's called holism or globalism or systems approach or whatever, right? And the question is, are there biological properties in the cell or in a tissue or in a body, and then also, you know, in a human disease that you will have to understand, and now I'm saying the word, the network that genes are involved in, and their gene products. And so that was sort of the big question of the mid-90s. I think now we know that it's probably going to be very important to consider both. By the way, both approaches are very important. Both the reductionist way of going into and trying to understand, you know, each gene as well as you can, but also to consider the complex networks that the gene products are involved in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I suspect what you're saying is knowing where that bolt is just as important as knowing how that bolt is made.
Yeah,
on this and
exactly.
On the
right.
Jet.
And how they all and how they all interrelate.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what I mean by the network, Leo. So and Mark, you're right too. So it's both approaches. Yes, that's right. How do they interrelate? Very nice. And you know, and at the end of the day, so you know, I guess the next word that we have to introduce then is wiring diagram, right? So if you go from, you know, a long Excel sheet list of all the parts of a 700, you know, a 757 and, you know, a couple of features for all the parts, doesn't get you very far. But if you start saying, okay, this part touches this one, and this one touches this one, and this one touches this one, you know, et cetera, et cetera, you still won't understand completely, of course, how the plane works. You know, you need to model the dynamic of all this to understand how the plane works. But now you have a wiring diagram, and it gets you closer to where you want to be, basically.
Could you compare 757 to a 767, 747? And how would you make that comparison? So I'm doing a reverse analogy.
Yeah.
Here. Which one's a nematode and which one's us, right?
Yes, that's right. You got it. Right. Yeah. Exactly. No, absolutely. I don't think, well, I mean, those engineers could. I'm sure that if they look at the wiring, you know, no, this is a great question. So is there anyone, or actually a computer, by the way, probably, you know, if you give the wiring diagram of two different planes to a computer, is there a model that the computer can use to actually recognize, you know, which wiring diagram corresponds to what plane? I don't know, guys, but I would imagine that the answer to that is yes. You know, but
there are probably some distinctive markers, as there would be in
right.
a genome. There's some distinctive.
Exactly. And so that's right. That's right. Well, actually, hold on. So if you do, okay. So if you take the genomes of those different species, yes, right away, you can, it wouldn't be a problem at all to recognize from what species it's coming from, I would say. You know, first of all, the number of genes might be an indication, you know, the sequence of the genes, etc. What I'm trying to say here is if you had a good sense of the wiring diagram of a cell, could you then say what species this cell belongs to? That's a very good question. You know, so I'm imagining that this will be the case, even if it's not right now. So, you know, by the way, why don't we, you know, let me just say what we mean by wiring diagram, at least in this lab here, but also, you know, sort of a field that's vastly developing now. And so the wiring diagram, from a pragmatic point of view, is made of essentially proteins, right, the product of the genes, and how they physically interact with each other, right? So for those who don't do biology every day, you know, proteins have shapes, and they fit with each other or not, like a key and a knob or whatever, and, you know, objects that fit inside or into each other, and we can test that, we can measure that, we can measure what we call physical interactions between proteins. And so if you start from one protein, you can ask, how many proteins that one interact with? What are those proteins? Then you go to those proteins. You say what do those proteins interact with, et cetera, et cetera. That's what I mean right now by wiring diagram.
How right? do you assemble the data set to create that wiring diagram? Because this will help put into context a little bit. You know, give people a little bit of a background on the assembly of that network.
Yeah, so you mean...
Because it's a fantastic story. You know, the nematode story of going after that network for C. elegans with 19,000 genes is just... Yeah. It's a huge, huge endeavor. And yeah, when did you start it? Because
I can tell.
That was at a time when people were really going one at a time. One group was doing yeast because it only had 4,000 or 5,000 genes, and you...
Yes. So actually, I can tell you this. This is there's some funny aspects to this, so probably it will be interesting to the listeners. I'm not sure. So basically, the inventor of the technique that we use, his name is Stan Fields. And he published this wonderful paper in 1989 describing how you could measure and detect and find, I guess, discover new physical interactions between proteins that have never been studied before, right? And, you know, I guess we don't have to go through the details of that, Mark. But in any case...
We can do the gross details would be simply that you express these genes recombinantly in yeast in pairs.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. That's right. Exactly. And so, and if the so you basically fool the yeast cells to express your two favorite genes of interest, and if the corresponding proteins can interact with each other, the yeast will tell you, basically. For those who are scientists, you'll activate a reporter gene and you can measure that. So,
and for computational person or an IT person, you get a binary response, either a zero or a one as to your data.
Right. Or actually, for those who study networks who are listening to us, you know, you probably know about sociological networks, and so you have to ask yourself, how do I draw my network? So, for example, if you were interested in a company and you wanted to understand some sociological features of it, you know, one way to draw a network would be to take people as nodes and then draw links between them if they exchange at least two emails a day, for example, or something like that, or if they call each other.
Isn't the NSA doing this now? So the ways that the NSA is picking out people is by looking at nodes, right?
Leo can probably answer that question.
No. I have no idea. I'm sure if there's a way, they're doing it, but I have no idea.
Well, I'm sure they're listening to what we're doing,
yes.
So they might answer their
yes,
question
exactly.
themselves.
Guys, any thoughts? They're silent.
Hello.
I don't understand.
Mark, I think you're right. It's exactly right. So, as a matter of fact, yes. So basically, there are people who are, for example, studying the networks formed by cell phone callers, right? So in that case, a cell phone is a node, and then the links between them are, again, a certain number of calls per day or something like that. And so, and we'll get into that, I guess, later, but the topology of those networks can help people like NSA to actually detect odd things, you know, sort of like, I guess, groups of people who call each other more often or whatever. And so I think those are the patterns that they're looking for. I have no clue. I'm just sort of, I haven't read much about this. But what I know is that's exactly what we're looking at in the networks inside the cells. So now, okay, let's just sort of take the analogy back and fall back on the feet of biologists here. So say you want to study a sociological network, people will be nodes, and you draw links between them if they exchange emails at a certain frequency. And then in our case, you take two genes, you put them in yeast, you fool the yeast cells, and if the two proteins corresponding to those two genes can interact, the yeast will tell you, will give you a signal. And so you write, Mark, it will be a binary you know, zero or one, yes or no. And then if there is a yes, then we draw a link between the two nodes corresponding to those two proteins, yes. So actually, you know, I just want to step back to that small anecdote that I wanted to tell you guys. So Stan Fields then decided to go ahead and start mapping networks. As a matter of fact, his lab published a map of the yeast network in 2000. Sort of a first version of the map, not perfect, but nice. And then during that time, I was interested in taking this concept and pushing it to multicellular organisms. It turns out, for those who don't know, yeast is a unicellular organism, and the biology of uni versus multicellular organisms can be a little bit different, actually. Very different. And so what I tried to do is to go to mouse. So I wanted to map the protein interaction network. By the way, sometimes we'll call it the interactome network. Interactome, you know, is meant to describe the complete set of all protein-protein interaction in an organism. So I wanted to map the interactome network of mice, and it turns out that the technology of it was so hard that I always tell this story. It took me 3 years to get one interaction, to two nodes, one edge between them, one link between them, and those two nodes were alpha globin and beta globin.
The most common proteins.
Exactly. Mark is a biologist. He knows exactly what that means. It was the most boring network anybody has ever mapped before.
Is that a bad result, though? I mean,
they're
the
false
fact
positives.
Is you've got they're false positives.
So, Leo, actually, good question. Mark, they are not false positives. So, okay. Actually, my percentage of false positive was zero. So that was cool.
That's good.
But my sensitivity was extremely low. So it's actually something I published. No, but because the interest of that experiment was that Exactly.
The sign of a true scientist to be able to publish even the...
Yeah, exactly. You know, because what was actually reassuring out of the experiment was that I was able to actually get rid of a lot of the noise and get to that, you know, one pair of alpha globin, beta globin. And, you know, there are technical reasons why it was only one, and it's boring actually really for this show. But anyway, so that's how I started. And then, Marianne Walhout, came to my lab in 1998. And just a little bit before that, I realized, you know, the mouse project was going to be very hard. And the reason why it was only one interaction was that we didn't have any genome sequence for mouse. And, you know, we didn't have a genome sequence for humans. So in other words, what I was trying to do, right, was to set up the wiring diagram of an organism for which I didn't even have the parts list. You see,
so you were setting up a library versus a library of randomized.
Okay,
genes.
So if we want to get into that, that's right, Mark. So what I did, for those who know about those things, is I basically took a cDNA library and I split it in two, and I fused one part to the DNA binding domain of the yeast-2 hybrid system and the other part to the activation domain of the yeast-2 hybrid system, and I put everything together in one tube after doing all kinds of, you know, control steps, and I ended up with alpha globin, beta globin. And the reason why there was only one that came out is because globin, as you know, is expressed at very high levels if you take small embryos of mice, which was my source of RNA to make the cDNA library.
So, and basically, so, the library represents the ratio of specific genes in a cell at any one time. So I guess when you pull the two libraries, it's going to be the one that's the most highly expressed against the other one that's most highly expressed that interact, and you're only going to get that one pair.
Yeah, you're right, Mark. And you know, and actually, it's so it. This is, by the way, this was a problem that had been recognized. And again, I feel from you two that I can be a little more technical than I am right now. So just correct me and just tell me if I'm being too technical now. But so Craig Venter and a couple of others, Bob Waterston and a number of other people at the early days of the genome sequence projects. And I guess this has a very general interest. So imagine those guys at the very beginning of it. Some people were saying we should sequence the entire genome, and because that will be done once and for all. You know, we'll have invested $2 billion from taxpayers' money, but then we'll have the human genome, and, you know, it'll be great. And then others were saying, come on, you know, only 1% of the human genome really corresponds to protein coding. So that's what we should sequence. We don't have all this money. You know, we should really sequence what quote unquote matters. The rest of it being called, if you recall, junk DNA. Well, we realize today, by the way, that what was called junk DNA perhaps is not so much junk as we originally thought. So, but in any case, and the reason, so basically that's how those EST and cDNA projects were started, you know, by people who said, let's sequence the coding. You know, we don't need
to. Sequencing is only half the work, because then you have to actually isolate the genes and then recombine them into the artificial system to test their binary.
That's
response.
Right, Mark. We'll get there in a couple of minutes, which is really the beginning of our work. No, you're right.
Yeah,
no. You're absolutely right. The only thing I wanted to say,
it's scary to actually do that.
I know, and I'll tell you a couple of stories about that. It was actually pretty funny too. But in any case, so for those who know about EST projects and cDNA libraries, picking clones randomly and that sort of thing, you end up at some point plateauing completely at about one third to one half of the genes. And the reason is that some genes are highly expressed, and so you tend to find them. And many genes are expressed at much lower levels, so you tend not to find those. But then, you see, what I was doing was to actually elevate this problem to the square, because remember, I was splitting the cDNA library. One was going to the DNA binding domain and the other one was going to the activation domain. So now it was, you know, problem times problem, basically, which is problem to the square. And what it gave us was, you know, beta globin, alpha globin. So what we knew then is we had to, you know, we realized at that point, okay, stop the cDNA library stuff. We need to have the parts list. We need to have a model of all the genes of a particular organism, and then we'll start from that. And the reason why then I switched to C. elegans was pretty much because at that time, they had, you know, first of all, such an to use that little joke that everybody uses all the time, this elegant model system, you know, it's amazing. No, seriously, I mean, you know, they know so much about this little beast. You know, some listeners might not know, but there are, for example, in the adult of this little worm, there are exactly 959 cells. always. You know, you look at any adult out there, at least in the lab conditions, and you count the cells. You look at the cells. It's always exactly 959 cells. They all
and
have
they're
a name.
Developmentally understood. Everybody, the life of each cell as it develops is pretty well characterized.
Well, it's not well understood at the molecular level quite yet, Mark, although we have a lot of information. But what I think what you're referring to is the cell lineage. So we do know for each one of those 159 cells, we do know where it's coming from. So in other words, what its quote-unquote parent cell is, and you know the parent of that one and the parent of that one, all the way up to the original egg that was first fertilized by a sperm cell. Does that make sense? So that's work by John Sulston, by the way, primarily with Bob Horvitz and Sidney Brenner to some extent. And some of those guys went on to get the Nobel Prize for some of that work. But the point was...
Two quick questions for you. How large is the genome, and what's its homology to the human genome? How closely are we related to the nematode?
So in terms of length, that is, you know, in number of nucleotides, the components of the double helix, the human genome is about 30 times bigger than the worm genome. And to give you a comparison on the other side of the window, the yeast genome is about 10 times smaller than the C. elegans genome. Now, when it comes to the number of genes that we think, and I'll come back to the reason why I say we think yeast contains, worm genome contains, and the human genome contains, then we have the following numbers. Yeast appears to have approximately 6,000 genes, and the worm genome appears to have about 20,000 genes. The human genome appears to have about 22 or 23,000 genes. So it turns out one of the surprising numbers here is that human beings seem to have the same number of genes as those tiny worms.
We're closer to worms than worms are to yeast.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess if that tells you anything, I don't know what to tell you.
I don't know what that tells you exactly. From that point,
where
of
do
view,
lawyers fit in this?
Depends what you mean by is.
But really, there's
only a few thousand gene sites that are different on humans than a worm, which is kind of amazing.
Yes. Well, and actually, you know, when and so I think that was Mark's question. So then if you actually take each one of the 20,000 genes for C. elegans and each one of the, say, 22,000, 23,000 genes for human, then it turns out in many cases, not all obviously, there are actually similarities between them, you know, 2x2 or, you know, 2x1, 3x1, etc. So in other words, they are cousins. The proteins encoded by the worm genes and the human genes, you could consider them cousins. We call them orthologs.
Functional. So you could take the worm gene, put it into a human cell that's been where it's been disrupted, or
yes, it's been shown in a few cases that this is indeed the case, and that can actually go down all the way to yeast. As a matter of fact, Paul Nurse demonstrated about 20 years ago that you could take a yeast mutant that couldn't do something because one of its gene was perturbed, was mutated, and you could take the corresponding cousin / ortholog from human and rescue the situation by again, quote unquote, fooling the yeast and forcing it to express the human gene, to use the human gene to do the function. So yeah, Mark, it's amazing the sort of the, you know, how those functions are actually conserved, again, one gene at a time. So now we're going back to Leo's point from, you know, 20 minutes ago, which is how the parts interrelate. I really like that word that you use, Leo. So, you know, the way that the products of 20,000 genes interrelate and the way that the products of 22,000 genes in human interrelate, that's the sort of the hypothesis now, might be different in a way that you, at the end of the day, you get a worm and at the end of the day, you get a human. So I'm not sure if this makes sense, but it is somewhat of a paradoxical, at least at first, that human would have the same number of genes than worms. Now, I want to say
that
one
wasn't
more thing.
Known at the time when you started this, though. When you started,
oh,
the
no.
Human genome, people were thinking 30, 50,000 human genes. So we
actually,
were.
So as a matter of fact, I'll tell you, when I'll give you the exact dates. I decided to go to C. elegans in the middle of the year 1997, at which time about, I would say, 20 to 30% of the C. elegans genome was sequenced. And from that, they estimated that the C. elegans genome would contain approximately 13,000 genes. And at that time, the best estimate for the human was 100,000 genes. You know, so when I started the map, we all thought that at least human beings would have 100,000 genes and worms would have, you know, about 10,000 genes, whatever. But I should say, though, there are two more elements to this that I'm sure those who do biology are dying to hear at this stage, to be completely fair. And one of them is, many of the of you guys will know that one gene can sometimes produce more than one protein. For example, there is this mechanism called alternative splicing. Mark, you know about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from which basically from essentially splicing, I guess the word says it all. Editing, I guess, could be another word that people could use, sort of the analogy to cinema and movie making. You know, from one gene, you can actually splice it in different ways and produce different proteins. Now, it turns out, apparently, that happens more in the human genome than in the worm genome. So that would mean that for 22,000 genes, you already could have many more proteins corresponding to that, if that makes any sense. Yeah?
So that's why you'd see more... a longer genome for human versus C. elegans, and I think in yeast there's very, very few splice variants, aren't there?
Yes, so. In yeast that's true. Yes, only I forgot the numbers here, but it's in a few percent kind of range. Yeah, that's true, and it's not necessarily the reason why it's longer. I think, Mark, and the reason is so. There are those and again, now we have to get into the technical stuff, but what's being spliced out of those genes to make proteins is called introns. You know, those are sequences that, again, people think that they don't do anything. It's sort of part of the junk DNA. Introns tend to be extremely long in the human if you compare them to the worm genome. And that's why the human genome is so much longer than the worm genome for approximately the same number of genes. And I want to say...
advantage to that?
Well, you know, so there's one more element to this, maybe, Mark, and I think there are new theories now that, you know, tend to suggest that. The work here that we do, we basically don't ask those questions, but it's fascinating. It's a fascinating type of problem. But I was going to say, though, that in addition to all this, there's a sort of a renaissance, not that it wasn't known before, but there's a new interest in the RNA that's being made out of the DNA. You know, so there was a sort of a trend for the last 20, 30 years or so to only study proteins. It's not the case for everybody. I'm sort of generalizing here. But now, apparently, there's this world of RNA that people really never quite understood how vast it was going to be. And then, and that relates back to your last question, Mark, then perhaps that provides an advantage. That might be a reason why the human genome is so much, quote-unquote, longer, because now you can imagine a potential of, you know, making different RNA molecules that is much greater in the human genome than it is in the worm genome. And so now, you know, let's summarize. From the same number of protein encoding gene, you have many more proteins in the human relative to worm because of the splice variant stuff. In addition to that, they might be, those are hypotheses, there might be many more RNA molecules that, you know, that are active in the human cell, and all those factors together might account for the different complexity between man and worms.
Let's go back to the networking.
Yes.
So now we've got a good understanding of where the C. elegans worm or C. elegans or nematode worm genome is with respect to the human genome. You set out to isolate every single open reading frame or
yes.
So gene. So that means the start of a gene, the end of a gene, everything in between that encodes for a protein, and then you set up a matrix to in yeast, large scale, and started mapping that. So what kind of results did you come out, did you get in terms of networks? Were there subgroups, islands?
Yes, exactly. Well, let me just answer your question first about the ORF cloning step in just one sentence, and then we'll get to the network. Because I want to say something though here, which is important, especially if you know, young computational biologists are listening to us. I always say, you know, that I sort of joked with the alpha globin and beta globin case, and it's a good way to introduce this notion now that I, you know. The message here is those genome sequences are amazing, right? I mean, what they gave us, you know, is just absolutely incredible. We couldn't have done the kind of work that we've done so far without genome sequences. No doubt about that. Now, once you've said this, then you say, okay, so what are genome sequences? Really, what do they give us? So the first thing they give us is a stretch of nucleotides, right? 100 million for the worm, let's say. And then compute...
I feel sad because...
Why are you laughing?
No, I you know, I still.
What's up?
What's the
I see a lot of people still working, you know, in an environment where genes are isolated one at a time, and that includes myself in many
like
cases.
A lot. Yeah,
because there's a lot of biochemistry that still needs to be done on single proteins, you know, as we were talking about before. So Mark's work is truly extreme bio, is extreme genetics or extreme biotech. So sorry, just me.
No, actually, I appreciate Mark, but again, you know, when I visit, you know, quite, you know, places like different departments around the country and that sort of thing quite a bit, and you know, so I love doing that. I love talking to the students, and you're right. There's still, you know, a huge bulk of people out there, you know, working on the beauties, and really it's beautiful, on the beauties of a single protein. You know, you had Sue Lindquist on this program. You know, I mean, she first, you know, she discovered the beautiful principles that they're working on. You know, sort of concentrating on one or two proteins. So there's absolutely nothing wrong with doing this. That, you know, that is not my point at all, right? But on the other hand, it I think it's a little silly to then refuse the idea that questions could be asked from a more global point of view. And I think, you know, if people got out of this 1 hour with the idea, well, you know, I guess we need both, and it would be nice if both approaches could be complementary. You know, that would be a great accomplishment. Anyway, so then, okay, so imagine this, right? So basically you say, okay, so now I have my genome sequence. There are computer programs that tell me where the genes are and, you know, what kind of proteins those genes might be encoding. But as you can imagine, relatively quickly, those models, those computer programs are not perfect, right? So when people say we have the parts list, it's true, we have the parts list, but we don't really know how each part looks like. You know, it's like back to the analogy with the 757, right? We know approximately how many parts, but we don't really even have a shape for any of those parts quite yet. I mean, we sort of have a sense for some of them, but it's still, you know, imperfect, and it will need improvement. So my only point is that, you know, I would love, you know, to know at some point how every single protein, you know, the primary structure of every single protein in the proteome. I mean, we don't know that. You know, it's only, you know, models at this stage. So I wanted to say that. So anyway, so you use those models, you sort of hope for the best, you cross your fingers, and then you take all those predictions and you start putting, you know, primers together and start amplifying by PCR for those who work with this sort of thing. You know, basically the coding region of every single one of those genes. So the coding region is called open reading frame, you know, open reading frame, ORF. And so we sort of introduced this concept of ORFilm, which is the, you know, the complete set of all open reading frames in the genome.
Have you made these available? I mean, if somebody were to ask for the complete set, how many plates is that to?
Yeah, so, genes? Okay.
The transcriptome.
Yes, it's actually not the transcriptome, Mark, because, well, the difference being, not that I want to play with words, but I think the principle here is important. In my mind, the transcriptome would contain the 5' and 3' UTR sequences, right?
Okay.
And we deliberately get rid of that, and we only have the ORF from the ATG to the stop. Does that make sense? So in other words, the transcripts in the cell are actually a little bit longer, right, than the open reading frame.
So an ORF is a unit of some kind, then? Forgive me for sounding stupid here, but I'm not.
No, I know, Leo. This is a little bit confusing. So imagine a stretch of DNA, right? And then that DNA is being transcribed into what we call RNA. Mm-hmm. And then what happens then, not necessarily in yeast, but like we were just talking about in worms and in humans and in other organisms, you need to splice, you need to edit this original RNA that you've produced and remove what we call the introns, right? And so at the end of that, you have what we call a mature RNA. It's mature now. It's ready to be used to make a protein. And this thing enters a machine called the ribosome, and it's being read, right, into the ribosome to make a protein. Now, the part that is being read, which at the end of the day, the important point is the part that is used as a template, as a blueprint to make the protein, that's the ORF. And we call that open reading frame. So in other words, if you looked at all the ORFs of an organism, you could, you know, have a good sense of all the proteins of that organism using the genetic code between the two. Mark, did I do a good job at that?
That was fantastic.
I understand that. All right.
Some okay. people pay a lot of money to hear that. And, yeah. I really appreciate our audience.
I'm getting it.
A chance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No problem. No problem. So by the way, I mean, again, if you are not a biologist here and you're interested in networks, you know, it's as if, again, imagine that you want to map your favorite network to try to understand some of its, you know, topology and all that kinds of stuff. You know, imagine that you first have to produce your own node. You know, it's like, you know, if you like, you remember the example I was giving about the company and the sociological network, where the, you know, at least people give you a list of people and they give you their email address, and so you can download the data and draw your network. You know, you don't have to make the people and you know, and then test whether or not they are sending emails to each other. We have to. In other words, you know, if we just look at the worm like this, that's not going to give us any node, because proteins are so small that they're invisible to any kind of technique. So we have to trick, and we have to use all those indirect methods. That's why we're going through this whole explanation about the genome sequence and the ORFeome and the ORF cloning, etc. So in summary, we have to make our own nodes. So, Mark, to answer an important question you asked a few minutes ago, yes, everything we do here is made publicly available. Probably one of the reasons why you're asking is this. I'll tell you about the history of this. So in order to, you know, people had cloned genes, and we hear this on the radio or on the TV all the time, right? The cystic fibrosis gene has just been cloned, as they said in 1989, or the Huntington disease gene has just been cloned at MGH in 1992 or 1993. So those were absolutely incredible events. You know, TV crews were at MGH. I still remember when Jim Guzzella and his group cloned this one gene, right? I mean, 10 years of effort, fantastic. But so imagine now trying to apply the techniques that were used to do that to cloning 20,000 genes. I mean, obviously there's a difference between the two. And so there is a technology that together with Life Technologies Incorporated, LTI, for those who will remember that acronym, which was then later on acquired by Invitrogen. We worked in collaboration with two scientists at LTI, collaborators, but also dear friends, Jim Hartley and Mike Brash. If they're listening, I say hi to them. And they're really cool people. And so what Jim and Mike had done is to think about using this beautiful reaction that lambda, a phage, a small little phage, lambda, the phage lambda uses a beautiful little reaction to integrate
this a virus that infects colon bacteria.
You're right. And okay. I was going to say, actually, it's something similar to how HIV actually integrates into the human genome. I mean, it's not the same mechanism, but conceptually, it's very close. So the phage lambda uses this wonderful reaction. And what Jim and Mike did was to actually make use of that and isolate the components and say, you know, why don't we use that to clone genes? And so they tried that with a couple of cases. And, you know, I came along, we started collaborating, and I said, what we're going to do here is to apply this to the entire ORFeome of an organism to go to, you know, 20,000 ORFs instead of cloning one or two genes. And so, you know, a couple of years went by, Invitrogen bought them, and Mark, you're probably asking the question for this, and it's still in some people's mind. For a while, Invitrogen was sort of, you know, threatening people that they would actually retain all kinds of rights on what was going to be done with this system, that, you know, people could not exchange the clones between each other. That is all changed now. They have a new CEO whose name is Greg Lussier, and he's a really cool guy, and he changed all this, you know, weird policies that they had. And so now all this is basically open as you could, you know. I'm not saying it's 100% open, but it's like pragmatically for us scientists to exchange stuff, Mark, and that was your question. There's no problem.
Yeah, once this has been done, this was a huge, huge effort to isolate all these genes and to put them
yes.
in the system.
Yes, yes, yes.
That would not need, it's like sequencing the human genome. You don't want to have to sequence it again. It's actually worse because there's a lot of chemistry involved to isolate each gene. That's very expensive. So I suspect.
Yes, that yes,
if
that's
it's available,
right.
It's fantastic.
So it is available. And also, what people should know about this, if they haven't heard about this at all, is that it's basically once we've captured an ORF, so again, the coding region of any gene, into the system. By the way, I don't think I've said the name of the system, Mark. I forgot. It's called Gateway, the Gateway system. Then what the advantages is that for 1, 10, 100, 10,000, or 20,000 genes, as long as we have captured them, it's very relatively easy for anyone to then take those sequences that we captured and move them, so to speak, to any kind of plasmid or vector that anyone would be interested in moving, provided that you've made your plasmid of interest gateway compatible.
To translate plasmid or vector, that would be artificial chromosomes that can be used in a recombinant organism.
Right, that's right. So it's
does that make sense, Leo? That's sort of these miniature chromosomes that you can bounce back and forth.
Yeah, you shouldn't use me as a test because I'm kind of following it. I'm doing my best here.
Actually, Leo, he was just testing if you're asleep or not.
I'm awake. I'm taking furious notes.
So moving to the human, Mark, was a little bit of a challenge early on because, again, remember the human genome sequence came out a little bit later than the worm genome sequence. And in addition to that, just to repeat it, you know, the human genome is much harder to annotate. Those guys are doing an amazing job. You know, some of them are in Hinkston, other ones are in Santa Barbara, if I remember, Santa Cruz, UCSC, I guess. You know, people like that are just, you know, ensemble, those people are just absolutely amazing teams. Trying to make the best out of the data and the models that we have at this stage. But unfortunately, you know, the human genome is so difficult to annotate that we still don't have a perfect, you know, set of ORFs for it. And so at this stage, we've captured about 12,000 open reading frames. We sort of did our best with, you know, the models that we have right now. And so we use this to then, maybe we should go and move back to this idea of building networks. So
Yes.
Right? So basically, you know, once you've been able to capture those ORFs, now you're able to produce your own nodes. And I guess the rest of it is really not, you know, rocket science. It's basically, you know, taking all the possible nodes that you've been able to express, you know, all the possible proteins that you're able to make in your test tubes, and then test them two by two in all pairwise combinations. And ask, and again, Mark was saying it's a binary response, if yes or no, at least, you know, in the window of the assay that you're using, whether or not that particular pair of protein is able to interact. And so you do this over and over and over and over again. To give you an example, the last paper we published in Nature about this with the beginning of the human interactome map, we did a matrix of 8,000 by 8,000, which is, you know, 64 million when you think about it. So we tend to test everything.
64 million crosses.
Yes, 64 million combinations of, you know, protein X by protein Y, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So
You identified new connections to your association with the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. You must have found disease associated proteins that had novel interactions, and how would you use those to
right?
That's the true benefit to this kind of, you know, in terms of humanity.
Exactly.
Not just basic science.
That's right. Exactly. So, let's say 2 minutes about the basic science, and then 3 minutes about human disease, and then we'll be done.
Research in 1 5-minute.
Here we go. That's right. So I guess the message is that if you start looking at those networks, they have properties of their own. You know, physicists like Laszlo Barabási, for example, who, by the way, is on sabbatical here in our center, discovered one topological property of the internet, which is that a small number of sites tend to be hyperlinked with a great number of other sites, while the vast majority of sites are, you know, hyperlinked like mine, I guess, like my website. So, you know, this very simple global property actually is applicable to the network of proteins that interact in our cell. You know, that's mind-boggling when you think about it, right? So in other words, there are apparently some, you know, topological properties that the network of interacting proteins seem to have. Now, Mark, to answer your question, if you then take the proteins that are involved, that are known to be involved in diseases, and you start looking at, you know, where they are in the network, do they represent particular nodes? Do they seem to be located in particularly important part of the network? Well, the answer to that we don't really have yet, but it's starting to smell good. So the early analysis with the data sets that we have today tend to suggest that, you know, we can start learning really new lessons about human diseases by looking at the network rather than, you know, basically working on that one particular gene involved in that one particular disease and doing that only.
Just from what I understand of business development, I think you could isolate the novel interactions, patent them as potential candidates for screening. Is that being done? And would this go back to, or is this NIH intellectual property or Dana-Farber?
No. So no. At least this is one of the big policy in our case. We're not patenting any of those interactions. And
okay.
I'm assuming that some of the companies involved in this sort of work, there are a couple of them, have done that, have had, you know, huge teams of lawyers to try to do this. But you know, Mark, you know what happened to sort of gene patenting and the EST stuff from the early 90s? You know, there comes a point where, you know, if you have tens of thousands of patents hanging there at the PTO with not much, not much information associated with them, not much content.
Oh, no, definitely. I agree.
Right? They tend to be diluted a little bit. And,
still 800 million to develop a drug from A to Z.
Right, so exactly.
It doesn't mean that one patent will give the...
Right.
It's not like having a patent on Viagra where that,
right.
You know, it's a yeah. $70 billion a year.
Right. So what I would say here is, you know, I like the analogy of the World Wide Web for this, you know, where essentially anybody can get anywhere on the internet. There's basically complete openness from one website to another, except for a few things that are, you know, outside of the legal stuff. But then, of course, that doesn't mean that people cannot make money, and people have made money on the internet, as we all know. So I tend to think that the Interactome network should be free for anybody to use, and then perhaps, you know, eventually somebody will find an interesting drug out of that information and make a lot of money. I'm not against that. But I think the primary setting, you know, the sort of the scaffold setting should be available to everybody, I would say. So that would be my two pennies on this one.
That was Dr. Mark Vidal and some amazing stuff. But, you know, I feel bad, Mark. We really didn't get to a lot of his current research. Can we do another one?
Definitely. I certainly classify Mark Vidal's work as extreme biotech. First, it takes a huge buildup to get an understanding of the nuts and bolts of his work.
Right. So I guess that's what we've done in this episode, is really kind of get you to the ground where you can actually understand what he's doing now.
Then we're going to enjoy an experience where he'll be able to expand into a lot of the theoretical biology that helps us understand the inner workings of a complete organism, which is a wild way to look at genetics. It's not genetics on a one-to-one gene basis, but really, you know, 20,000 or 30,000 genes at a time. So it's going to be fun. I'd like to thank a few people.
Yes, please.
I'd like to thank Abigail Bird for setting up Skype at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. As always, I always like to thank Harry Gill and Mark Parker for reviewing the week's show notes. I'd like to thank Will Hall for writing and giving us the permission to use the music as a theme to Futures in Biotech. It's a lot of fun.
I also like to thank the Jimmy Fund, because I was just at the Fenway Park, and I remember growing up, and the Jimmy Fund was always there, the little boxes. And it turns out that funds the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. So I dropped a few bucks in there. And the next time you're watching the Red Sox, drop a few bucks in the Jimmy Fund, because it's for a very good cause.
And lastly, the disclaimer. The ideas and opinions expressed here do not reflect those of Yale University or the Yale School of Medicine. That's
and
a show.
My opinions and reflect nothing whatsoever. They're completely worthless. Take them as you get them and do what you will.
You have true academic freedom, Leo.
I do. Nobody's looking over my shoulder. Mark,
the
always a pleasure.
School of Leo Laporte.
We have some great ones coming up, some fascinating interviews, including coming down the road, an interview with John Bergeron, who is the head of the Human Proteomics Organization. And that will be fascinating. So some great interviews coming up. I hope you're enjoying Futures in Biotech. We'd love to hear your comments at the webpage, twit.tv, or you can send them along to me or Mark, because we want to make this the best possible podcast. We feel like it's an important area, and we want everybody to have a chance to learn from what's going on out there. Thank you, Mark. We'll see you next time.
Thanks again, Leo.
On Futures in Biotech.